everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm Lori Galvin. I'm a literary agent at Zachary Schuster Harmsworth. I work on food projects and also lifestyle projects, but I'm open to a variety of other genres. So don't be shy and hit me up for a card afterward. And a reminder that all of the author's books are for sale, and they are would be delighted to sign them after. Food, especially today, has become a complex cultural touchstone and talking point, whether it's never-ending stream of food photos on Instagram. I'm very guilty of that. The number of cookbooks published every year, which according to Nielsen is around 5,000, or the obsession people have about what people eat, what they don't eat, and how that defines them as a person or a presidential candidate. So the authors we have today use food and the act of cooking to underscore and elevate a variety of themes in their books, and yes, to make us hungry. So welcome. You have the official bios, but I would like to introduce you to our panels today here. First, we have Dawn Lerman, My Fat Dad author, is a New York Times blogger where she has been sharing her story of her bohemian food-centric family for the past 4 years. Her dad was one of the original Mad Men, responsible for slogans like Coke is it and Lego my ego. She believes every memory from her childhood is attached to food. Louise Miller, the City Baker's, the author of The City Baker's Guide to Country Living, and her protagonist, Olivia Rawlings, are both pastry chefs at private clubs in Boston. Louise, however, has never lit any of her places of employment on fire or had an affair with any of the members. Livy wishes she could say the same. And Jennifer S. Brown, like her main character Rose, Jennifer bakes challah every week for her family, but unlike Rose, she has the luxury of an electric mixer to do so. Her Passover brownies are to die for, literally. They are packed with so much butter, they come with a medical waiver. So welcome. I think I'd love to start out by asking what your challenges were in writing about food. Or how did you think of food as adding texture to your books? And why don't we start with Dawn?
I don't think it was a challenge to add food to my memoir. My memoir is all about food. Every memory from my childhood is attached to food. I grew up with a 450-pound father, and every week he was on a new diet. And no matter what diet he was on, we had to be on. So when he only ate apples for a week, I only had to eat apples for a week. When he went to the fat farm at Duke University when I was 10 years old, I had to go and eat only little bowls of rice for the whole summer, even though I was like the scrawniest kid in my class. So writing about food is the fiber of my memories. And in contrast to growing up with a 450-pound father, I had a grandmother who loved to cook. And every week she would send me a recipe card with a $20 bill. And that kept us bonded. And that memory of cooking with her before I moved away from her and cooking her recipes nourished me for life.
Oh, that's really wonderful. Do you want to weigh in, Louise, on what you...
Sure, yeah. It's funny, I'm a pastry chef, and so my biggest challenge writing food in the book was not being too technical. I had a really hard time, like, not including all the instructions. So my editor was kind of constantly cutting, trying to get me to cut back on the food description, so it didn't sound like I was writing a cookbook instead of a novel. But I used food in The City Baker. It's a lot of craft elements. The inciting incident that gets the whole thing started is revolving around a baked Alaska, and what we refer to as the spine of the novel, kind of driving force of the novel, is this very competitive apple pie contest at a county fair. And I find that, I mean, food and the relationship to food kind of defines my three main characters. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it wove its way into kind of every part of it.
Yeah, it was very much like a character, I thought, too. Almost like the music. There was, it gave a lot of the prose like a nice rhythm. And I one of my favorite scenes is when you're describing the contra dance and the lattice. of a pie.
Thank you. I thought that was really wonderful. Something I thought a lot about. I mean, it was really easy for me because I'm a pastry chef, so I kind of think this way. But I tried to have her see the lens that she was looking through at the world was really through the things that she baked. So there's the lattice pie of the dancing, and there's, you know, hay bales that look like jelly rolls, and so that worked its way in too.
Yeah. Jenny.
So I think that in my book, food is used in a very different way, because Dawn's memoir is specifically about, you know, her father being overweight, and Olivia Rawlings is a pastry chef who starts a fire and goes off and being a cook. Whereas my novel, it takes place in 1935 in New York City, and it's about an immigrant mother and her American-born daughter, and they both have unplanned pregnancies. So you're thinking, what does that have to do with food? Food for them is such a cultural touchstone. Right off from the beginning of the book, the family is Jewish, and as such follows the laws of Jewish eating, kashrut, being kosher. And I think a lot of people know you don't eat pork, you don't eat shellfish, but there are a whole lot of other rules. So Dottie is 19 years old, and she works in a midtown office, and she's immediately separated from her coworkers because they all go out for lunch, but she can't go out for lunch with them because she won't eat that non-kosher food. And it also sort of highlights the cultural, you know, a lot of the discriminations. She pulls out a sandwich, and, you know, her coworker right off the bat was like, ooh, is that Yid food? Which, you know, there was a lot of racial and religious tensions in those days. And when we first find her mother, Rose, she's actually preparing the food for the Friday night dinner. And in those days, you know, when I make dinner for Friday nights, honestly, I go to Whole Foods, I pick up one of the roasted chickens that they've already done. But where she had to actually, like, you know, be removing feathers and pieces and doing it all strictly by the rules. So it immediately sets up this distinction between tradition and modern. And writing about it was a challenge because it was not within my experience to cook like this, and I had to do a lot of research. How would you do this in 1935? And, you know, from what did it cost to what was the process? And, you know, one of the critical scenes is the daughter Dottie goes out for lunch with the father of her the pregnancy, and he takes her to a non-kosher place and sort of tests her. And it was fun for me because I was researching menus. What did they serve at the Stork Club in 1935? And so I was able to do all that. So there was a little bit of a challenge. So food definitely plays a very different role, mm-hmm. but still a very important role in the novel.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Dawn, there are so many recipes in your book. They're absolutely packed. And it's sort of a fun retrospective of what people were eating from, I guess, the 1950s or 60s.
The 70s.
And do you want to speak to that a little bit about some of the...
I'm a nutritionist, so I'm like obsessed with like healthy cooking, but it starts with my roots. So the book, you know, opens up where I'm going to my grandmother's house on the weekend. And even though my dad was always eating, he was in the ad world, so he was eating out. And my mom hated cooking. She only like would eat a can of tuna fish. So I was always hungry, except on the weekends, I would go to my grandmother's house. And every weekend, every Friday night also, was Jewish cooking. I'd walk in her door and there was the smell of this delicious chicken soup and dill. And before I even had words, I just remember the smell, how that smell inhaling her soup changed my emotions and how it filled my soul. And so her soup is something that I've always made. I make it exactly as she did it because it conjures memories from my childhood. And so there's many dishes. So every chapter has a different food memory attached to it, whether it's my grandmother's chicken soup or when we went to the fat farm, just like steamed rice. Or when I moved to New York City, I walked into the health food store and I thought I was Holly-Golightly walking into Tiffany's. Something about it was so overwhelming. Like the blenders with the fruits and the juices to me felt nourishing. So then I like have a macrobiotic apple pie. So the different recipes go from like, you know, the 70s to the 80s. And as the book evolves and the time evolves, so do the recipes. Because you could see food is so trendy and it's always changing what's good, what's not good. So the recipes evolve. And then at the end of the book, I have a swap chart. So if you don't want to use, you know, schmaltz, you could use coconut oil. So there's all kinds of like modern ways to make Jewish food or other food like healthier or to like, you know, adapt your diet, whether it's gluten-free or whatever. But that's just like a little appendix at the beginning of the thing. But the, so the recipes basically evolve as the times evolve.
Did you have to cook a lot of the recipes?
I cooked every, because it's a cookbook. So I cooked everything. And there's many recipes, like I said, like the soups that I cook all the time. But there's other things like mandelbread and rugula, which are like intensive rolling out and have a lot of sugar that I didn't make anymore. But my kids were thrilled because most of the time I'm making like chia seed pudding with avocado. So they were more than happy for me to make like all these like decadent desserts, homemade apple strudel. And so it was a lot of fun.
And I love the scene that where you're talking about your April, your little sister, and it was like a little sort of take on pecan pie. It was like a date.
Yeah, so when me and my sister were little, my parents would go out on the weekend, and we'd play this game called Big Sister, Little Sister, and whoever was, like, the big sister would make a snack for the little sister. So I was 9, and my grandmother sent me these recipe cards every week. So I was by 9, I was like a great cook, chef. But at 3, my sister couldn't really cook much, but she'd be like, no, I'm the princess now. You're the princess now. I'm going to make you food. So she like came up with a recipe, which is now really trendy. She cut open a date and put some peanut butter and smashed a Cheerio on it. And she's like, it's pecan pie. So, yeah. So.
Very sweet. Louise, there's so much amazing food described in your book, especially the pie, which is... the novel wraps up with the pie contest. I don't want to give things away, but how did you sort of choose what recipes to talk toward? And like, I know pie is iconic, but was something else in the running or?
Well, I'll say one of the inspirations of the book is actually a true story, which is back, it was probably 1999, I entered an apple pie contest at the Topsfield Fair here in Massachusetts. And so I made an apple pie and I dropped it off at the kitchen and I went and petted the goats and I saw the giant pumpkin. And they said, you know, come back around 7 and we'll tell you who the winner is. And so I went to the kitchen at 7 and there's a big, I don't know if anyone's been there, but it's a big arts and crafts building and the kitchen is separated by a glass wall. And so it's lit up. So anyway, so I walk into the building, and the lights are dimmed in my memory. They probably weren't. But the lights were dimmed, and I found like 100 women all gathered around the glass wall, staring into the kitchen, watching 3 judges eat pie. And until that moment, I had no idea that this contest was really competitive. I had no clue. And so it ended up being a record number of pies that entered that year, and the judging went really late. And so I stood and I watched people eat pie for another hour. And I just left there, and I was haunted by this image for years of like, why? What's at stake here? You know, what? Why do all these people want to win so badly that they're willing to watch people eat, which is kind of gross? So I knew very much at the onset, like that image. I knew that image would be in the book. So I knew apple pie was kind of a driving force, but I never intended to include a recipe in the book. But that was something that my editor really wanted to do. And we went back and forth at a certain point there. I think there were 5 recipes in the book. And we finally, the thing with me is that the way I write recipes, much like how I talk, is I ramble. And so I see writing recipes as telling a story. And she wanted to include the recipes actually in the book, like okay, not at the end. And I felt like it was too much like telling stories inside of another story, and it felt really disruptive to me. So our compromise was 1 recipe at the end, because that's where it belonged, because the recipe is a little bit of a spoiler. I don't remember the other part of the question, but...
What happened at the pie contest?
with my pie contest. I won second place. Straight out. There's a picture in my kitchen of me and Mrs. Essex County, who was there to present the prizes. And there's a beautiful big red ribbon in my kitchen, which I'm very proud of.
I did, just following up on that, what was I going to ask you? I'm sorry. I thought it was interesting, the city taste versus the country taste, and, you know, how did you approach that?
It was interesting. I think this is like a secret, like Louise's secret brain, but I am a pastry chef, and I do plated desserts in a restaurant. But it's totally to not my taste. Like, if you know me personally, I spend a lot of time fussing about what I call, like, tall food. Like, I just, and the styles have really changed since I started, and I think that things are much earlier, like, earthier. But the kind of food I'm interested in is, I love baking, like, historical desserts. It's something I get really excited about. And I love, you know, pies. I joke that if I have a specialty, it's pudding. Like, I love making rice pudding, tapioca, bread pudding, very homey desserts. And so I kind of played with Olivia being really focused, you know, her taste at the beginning is this kind of more elevated food, but, and it's a counterpoint to another main character who's the owner of the inn, who keeps things very strictly simple New England style. So yeah, it was fun to play with.
But she was somewhat flexible. The macarons, which I thought might have been too fancy, but they were, you know, they were tolerated.
I love it. There's a scene where it's a bake sale for the library, and she brings these chocolate almond macaroon cookies. And I love the idea that she thinks they're kind of fancy, but then when she actually gets to the bake sale, there's some pretty high-end cookies, and she realizes this is not like a normal bake sale situation.
Jennifer, one of the things I loved about your book is, like, I felt like I was in 1935. Mm-hmm. It was so detailed, so much research. Did you find anything surprising or interesting around food and diet during that time? I know we touched on that a little bit earlier, but
it was really interesting to study. Of course, just in the 1935, you're like right smack in the middle of Depression. So, you know, when I was looking at these recipes, they were recipes that would horrify most of us today because they really used everything they could. I mean, there was like pickled calves feet, like, which is not something that I think any of us would really be excited about having at our dinner plate. But they really tried to use every part of food. And the recipes were very, I went on archive.org, I don't know if anyone's ever been on that site, but they've scanned like zillions of things, and they actually had a ton of old cookbooks. And I actually went back too far, and I'm like, no, I gotta just focus on what I need to do. But it was just really interesting because it was not just the cookbooks, but sort of how you managed your kitchen, and how you cleaned your kitchen, and how you did all these things. And it was really very interesting in sort of layering, understanding how people lived. And for all immigrants who were coming into the country at the time, you know, there was a big push to assimilate people through food, right? So they started the school lunch programs and really had the kids eating American food. There were also settlement houses. They have settlement houses here in New York City. The ones in New York City were started by, the Jewish settlement houses in particular were started by the German Jewish population who came earlier, who was very assimilated, and they were very embarrassed by the new immigrants coming in who were doing all these strange things. So these settlement houses were meant to Americanize them and teach them hygiene and teach them American ways of doing things, but there was a big emphasis on American food, right? So like a kid could come home talking about like a Frankfurter or something, and parents are like, what are you talking about? So there was definitely a divide between like the younger generation and the older generation in the foods they ate. You're getting more packaged foods. Because the family kept kosher, I had to like research, like there was a cookie, I can't remember what they're called, the chocolate cookie, the vanilla cookie with like a chocolate center, Stella Dora. That existed then, that was kosher back then, that everyone would have eaten. And I talked to a lot of people. I interviewed people, and I was like, "What did your family eat?" So it just is so interesting to me how food played just such a huge role. I mean, first there was this sheer fact of could you afford it, and then once you afforded it, how you cooked it, what you did with it. And I mean, just even the way you prepared a piece of beef really sort of showed where your family came from. And so that was really, really interesting to me. And some of these, you know, these cookbooks, like I actually had one of my grandmother's cookbooks, and the recipe literally starts with, like, pluck the feathers, you know, off the chicken.
Wow.
And I was just like, I couldn't even fathom doing that, you know, on a weekly basis. Yeah. And
I just want to add to that, like, food is such a cultural touchstone, no matter, like, who you are. Mm-hmm. Food is a universal language. It doesn't matter, like, what country, what time period. Food is something that brings people together, creates memories. It's something we all do and most people love. So I think it's really interesting learning about the different times and to see what sticks and what doesn't stick. People are so worried about, I'm a nutritionist, and people are so worried about, like, what's in, what should I eat? But it's not really so much about, like, what's on trend. It's really about the time spent cooking and just the smells, and that if you could, you could just nourish yourself through the smells. And if you're eating things you love, you're going to eat less of it, and you're going to feel good, and you're going to have great memories around food. And I think that's really important.
And that's true. And like part of in the book, you know, she knows she's left her Midtown office and come home when she enters the building, and all of a sudden it's hit with the smell of boiled cabbage. You know, I think cabbage was very popular in the 30s with a lot of populations because it was so cheap and it was filling. And, you know, like this, just this overwhelming smell of the food in the hallways. And it's been really interesting because people have said, like, you know, if you replace the challah with this kind of bread, it's my, you know, Italian family or my
right,
Irish family.
Exactly.
So I think it's something that's a universal.
Did you make anything in preparation for the book? Like that?
I did.
Did you do the pickled?
I did.
Pig's feet? No.
I did not do pickled calf's feet. I went through the cookbooks. One of the things that the Mother Rose makes all the time is a coffee cake, and I thought I'm going to make a coffee cake. And then I opened up the book, and the first thing it said was like, I don't remember what, something fresh yeast. And I've known Louise for a while, and so I called Louise, and I was like, what is this, and how do I do this? And she's like, just use a regular packet, get it in the grocery store, it's all fine. And I decided I was going to do it like they had it in the book. I was going to do it the old-fashioned way. And the one thing I did that she wouldn't have done is I had to YouTube a few things to figure out how you do it. Like it said to scald the milk, and in my day I was just put the milk on the thing until I was like, oh my God, the pan's brown. Apparently that's not the way to do it. So I looked up a bunch of the techniques, and there was one where it said stir the dough for 10 minutes. So I was like, okay. And I started stirring, and it was so hard. And my husband looked at me and he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I've got to stir the dough. He's like, give it to me. He lasted for like a minute. He's like, yeah, this is impossible. And the thing had to keep, I mean, it took forever because it had to do this rise and then this rise. And I will say, it turned out really, really good. It was like one of the best coffee cakes I've made. And I made it again, but I used my KitchenAid mixer and, you know, I did it in like half the time and it still tasted just as good.
So, that's good to know.
Yes, it was, but again, lots of butter.
Yeah, I think your scenes of cooking and food really showed how much time women spent in the kitchen.
One of the things I was really surprised about when I was doing my research is they talked about women would go down to Ellis Island and bring new immigrants food, like different people from different cultures. So the Jewish woman would make the Friday night bread, the challah, and they'd make extra loaves to bring down. You know, they took turns. They were all part of societies. And I think this was something that a lot of the different communities did. So they would make like 8, 10, 12 loaves of bread on a Friday morning, and they'd have to get up before it was even light out to get the stuff rising and, you know, all that kneading by hand. I mean, it's just, they must have been just whipped. It's hard stuff.
Dawn, you have such an interesting perspective on food and cooking. In your book, you know, caught between one parent who loves food too much and one who doesn't like it very much. And the relationship between you and your grandmother is just really beautiful.
Thank
you. Her name is Beauty. How have these experiences informed, you know, food for you, diet, your relationships with your own children?
Well, I'll go with my grandmother saying, She used to say, good food is not fast, fast food is not good, and if you know how to make a pot of chicken soup, you can nourish yourself for life. So that's kind of my philosophy, is to go with fresh food made with fresh ingredients. And the other thing she'd always say, so this was, Lori's referring to my maternal grandmother, and I called her Beauty because when I used to go to her house on Friday nights, you know, I would walk up her stairs, and she'd go, Beauty, Beauty, and I'd say, Beauty, Beauty. So I thought she was telling me her name, so I called her Beauty. So Beauty was my maternal grandmother, and she had all these little, if anyone's read Michael Pollan, that's all the things my grandmother would say. So she'd be like, if you, and again, this was not my dad's mom who was 450 pounds, it was my mom. And she'd be like, if you don't want to look like your daddy, she's like, this is what you need to know. You got to smell your food. Does it smell like strawberries? If it doesn't have a smell, then you shouldn't be eating it. So I thought that was really wise. So to this day, I love food, but I have no interest in like a package of chocolate chip cookies. If I want a chocolate chip cookie, for me, my rule is it has to have a smell. You have to have, you know, it has to be made with love. So a lot of her teachings and her just her words have stayed with me. And as I was going through the book, I was having my daughter test a lot of the recipes because I wanted to make sure it was really easy. So we were able to kind of recreate the smells and the tastes from her kitchen. And it was just a lot, like Jenny was saying, it was just so much time was put into it and so much love. And one of my greatest memories is like shopping with my grandmother. We, you know, instead of having everything delivered, we go to the butcher, we go to the baker, and we related to the different people around it. So we made sure we always had the best ingredients. So when I work with clients as a nutritionist, I'm like, it's not about this diet, it's not about this diet. I always say, close your eyes and what's your best food memory? What's your best meal from your childhood? And start with that, because if you're nourishing yourself from the inside, that's going to be a lot more fulfilling than just like grabbing what's gluten-free, because you're never satisfied. So it's like my dad, you're always looking for something with a marketing product, but it never fills you up.
Nice. Louise, were you ever a cook at an inn, or is that something?
No, I've never. It's like kind of the only place I haven't worked is an inn.
Yeah, I've dreamed of.
Yeah. I would love to. That's a total fantasy.
I did that once, and it wasn't that fun.
Like most fantasies come true.
I really love the character of Olivia, and she, you know, she's so comfortable. I love how she says that about the kitchen is sort of the same everywhere, and it's maybe more of a, like, almost a spiritual thing in the kitchen for her. And she, you know, she comforts people with food. She throws, you know, herself, what was it? I couldn't believe how many pies she was making on Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was, like, stress baking.
Is that a little bit of you, or is that...
No, it's funny. Okay. I come home and I don't cook at all. My partner who's here cooks all the food at home. Because for me, it's a craft, but it is what I do all day. So it's, so I have a different relationship now than I used to. But I really do, her view of the kitchen is very much mine. And I've had a lot of different jobs. And it's just this kind of wonderful... like kitchen culture is just something I really love, and it really is consistent. There's a lot of variations on the theme, but I really do feel comfortable walking into any kitchen and feel like I could just start working wherever I go. And Olivia she's been raised by a single father, and he dies when she's 16, and she's been on her own for a really long time, and so. For her, it's the kitchen is like a stabilizing factor. It doesn't have to be the same kitchen, but she knows that's a place where she's very comfortable and has like a lot of authority and just a feeling of strength. Like,
and your hours are often long as a pastry cook.
Yeah, they can be.
So how did you find time to do your writing?
Oh gosh, it was. That's a great question. It started, I mean, the first draft took me 3 years. It was really fits and starts. My work has a predictable schedule in that the summers where I work are really quiet, so I would write more then. So when I'm in a normal writing pattern, I work downtown and I work around the corner from the Athenaeum where I'm a member. So when I'm in a rhythm and I'm in the middle of a project, I try to go right from work to that library. There's like literally like three doors, so I try not to let myself get too distracted. And I have, it's actually worked its way into my writing process. So what I do is, at the end of my writing session in the afternoons, I write down myself a list of questions that I have to answer for the next scene. And I tend to bring those questions to work. And I spend all day, I have so many hours a day where I'm just like chopping strawberries or like, you know, rolling out biscuits. And so it's this kind of wonderful chance to answer those questions. I get to just mull things over all day long. So that helps speed things along. So when I actually am sitting down at my computer, I'm not trying to answer a lot of questions. Oh, it's just kind of really doing the work.
Yeah, so you meditate over it.
So I'm always pushing writers. I'm like, you should become a baker, because it's like the absolute like best combination, I think.
I have a couple of just general questions. Were there any authors that you used as inspiration in approaching food in your books?
I don't know if I'd say inspiration. I mean, there are a lot of writers who write novels that incorporate food. And I've been really impressed with some of them. I mean, how many novels have you read where there's like a dinner time scene? It feels like dinner is a really fraught place for any family. The book that, like, one of the books that really jumps out at me, and the first time I really sort of noticed how food could add this layer of like setting a place and setting a time, was in Joseph Roth's Radetzky March, which takes place in Austria-Hungary, you know, right around the beginning of World War I. And there's a character who's very rigid in his eating, and everything had to be a certain way. And the foods really sort of defined the place, and it defined the time, and the way he approached them, you could sort of see how that defined his family, right? His family was not allowed, his son was not allowed to speak at certain times while he was eating. And I was just thinking, like, could this scene have taken place another way? And it could have, but not with the same intensity. You know, and I think the way people eat reveals so much about who they are. You know, whether you're, like, scarfing down that food on the run, or you have to sit down, or if you're one of the families who, you know, every meal's in front of the TV. Like, you can just interpret so much about characters through that. And Roth did that so beautifully in the Radetzky March. It's a really, it was a book I picked up. It's sort of a war book in a sense. And I was like, I don't even know how I picked it up. I was like, there's no way I'm interested. And then I couldn't put it down. It's a wonderful book, so.
That's funny, because one of my favorite, like, pieces of food writing is also a war book. And it, of all things, it's Cold Mountain. And it's about lack of food. And it really stuck with me, because there are these moments where there's, you know, the struggle to get the eggs from the hen, who are really aggressive, and then the hen stops laying eggs, and there's just no more eggs, and then they kill the hen to eat it because there's no more food, you know.
Right.
And that's always just really stuck with me, because I think it's something that we take so much for granted, just being able to go to a store and buy whatever we want. And this, we had an ice storm a few years back. And I remember, like they couldn't bring trucks in to bring groceries, and I remember just groceries running out of things. And it gave me this just, like, a little, for, like, a split second, I kind of related to people that, like, prep for end times. Because I was like, oh, my God, like, I can't grow food or, you know, food. Or, like, if the, you know, the tractor trailer doesn't come, I am in trouble. So that the Cold Mountain really stuck with me in food ways.
I read some of Ruth Reichel, because she kind of also had a very dysfunctional relationship with her mother, and her mother had a very dysfunctional relationship with food. And she had a lot of scenes where her mother was like, she would take like food out of the refrigerator that had mold on it, just take off the mold and hand it to her. I'm like, I read that, I'm like, that's what my mother did. I didn't know anyone else's mother like went to the store and bought like Velveeta cheese that had like mold like all over it, and cut it off and been like, but it's half the price. I'm like, well, now there's half the cheese. So I had fun reading hers, because it just felt me feel like, oh my God, I'm not the only one. But it's always fun to read what people's relationship with food is, because as you said, it really defines who you are. Again, it like either nurtures you or depletes you. And I had both, from both my parents, I was always depleted. And then from my grandmother, I had the nurturing. And I've hoped I've like, now yeah. I try and like inspire other people, my clients, my kids, but it's such food and the way we eat it is such a meaningful thing. And having family recipes, I'm just gonna read a quick quote that Ray Romano wrote. I thought it was like the best thing. He said it better than I did in like one sentence. Whether you're Italian, Jewish, or anything else, you can relate to how food, family, and the love of both affect how we grow up and live our lives. Manja.
Oh, very nice.
So I thought that was really nice. I thought it really...
As I say, one of the things that's really interesting when you talk about food writing, though, is just how vast it is now, right? Like, whether it's used in a novel, Barbara Kingsolver's Animal, Vegetable, Mineral is, like, a really gripping story about her growing her own food. And at the same time, the new one, Sweet Bitter by Stephanie Dandler, I think it is.
Yep.
You know, she's a back waiter at the Union Square restaurant or something very similar to it, right? Like, there's so many books that approach it in so many different ways now, and it's such an integral part. And, you know, I mean, you can't go without picking up, but you can't go to the bookstore without seeing another food memoir or one of these fictional versions of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really intriguing to me just how people are coming at it from all sides.
Yep.
Well, it's interesting too, though, because like when I started cooking, chefs were not rock stars.
Right. Now
it's just like, you know, it was only PBS that had Saturday morning cooking shows, and there were a few, and the whole culture has changed so rapidly around food and the way people relate to it. And I have like friends, children's, who I think are better pastry chefs than I am. And they've you know, they're like, oh, you buy your fondant? Like, I make mine. Great, they're nine. You know, so it's a really different world now. It's interesting. It's exciting, I think, like the way, especially about local food people being really more in touch.
The whole farm to table movement and all the like, you know, cooking shows really kind of put food on the map.
Right. Yeah. People are more curious, and I think that's a good thing. Speaking of curiosity, I'd love to open it up to questions. We have a microphone here if anybody would like to ask anyone anything. Yeah. People can just come up and
Either way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I just have a simple question, or more or less an opinion question on your opinion on because we have so many choices and there's so many different things that are happening. I've noticed that there are some mothers who tend to take it a little too far. If you know what I'm saying, in terms of controlling the food, but it's become almost like an obsession with that. Did you find that, you know, at least in the 70s and 80s, I don't remember my parents being that obsessive.
No, at 9 years old, I went everywhere. I had my Subway tokens, and I was off. I had my, a dollar if I had, and I was off on my own for breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever. So, and no, I'm totally the opposite. I might be a little bit on the obsessive side. You're always trying to make up, right? So my mother was trying to, her mother was always cooking, so that was her rebellion. Mine is my rebellion against my mother who always cooked. But yeah, in general, yes, mothers today are very, you know, everyone's posting on Instagram their food photos of their lunchbox.
Yeah.
Right, so I do think, and everyone is like on the, again, as I was saying, like, are you paleo? Are you gluten-free? Are you this? I'm like, you're a nutritionist. I'm like, no, I just eat. But I'm mindful of what I eat, and it's like what my grandmother said, I try and eat good food that has a smell, and that's good quality food, but I don't have to put a label on it, and I don't have to obsess with my kids. And at home, we eat pretty healthy, but when they're at their friends, I just let them eat whatever they want, because otherwise, they'll be like my dad, and it'd be like, whatever you're being deprived of, then you're going to want to indulge in. So I think moderation is good.
I think I have a slightly different opinion on that, in the sense of, like, when I was doing my research, I think that a lot of the immigrant parents coming in were very much controlling about what their kids ate, right? Like, you're not eating enough, and a lot of them came from a history of want,
right?
So people who immigrated here... doesn't matter where you immigrated from, a lot of people came from places where food was scarce. And so when they got here, it was really important to make sure their kids were eating. So they were very careful of, like, did you clean your plate?
Yeah.
And I mean, they didn't have as many rules because nobody knew paleo or gluten-free or whatever it was. And then my feeling is that there was probably a reaction to that in a lot of our parents
who
then were like, do whatever you want and backed off. I mean, my mom was working all the time. I mean, I Swanson family dinners and Stouffer's tuna casseroles were my best friend. And if I wanted something else to eat, then I had to cook it myself. And so, you know, I think that it's a hard balance because parents also weren't being inundated by the media telling you, this is bad for your kid, and you're going to give your kid, cancer if you give him this and this, and you have to do organic. No, wait, organic really doesn't make any difference. And so I think that that leads to more of a confusion today. I think we can probably share the blame on this.
I just wanted to say one thing about my great grandmother and great grandfather, they're Irish. Mm-hmm. So we weren't dealing with a lot of choices back then. But when he retired, she retired, which meant that she no longer did any of the cooking. She just said,
wow.
Yeah, which I think is a wonderful family story. It was like he valued her work enough to say, you don't have to do all of what you did when I was working. And I just think that that's just a wonderful.
That's really nice.
I think my grandfather would have liked it if my grandmother had retired because she was not a good cook. but I'm sure it was not the same in your family.
No, my grandmother, sadly, it was macaroni with a slice of American cheese on top. It was her mac and cheese.
I don't have children, so I can't speak to that. But I think it's interesting from a cook's perspective that people's relationship to food has really changed. And I see that daily. I'm a vegetarian, so I'm used to, if I'm going to a party ahead of time, to kind of make a special request because I'm assuming they're going to serve a piece of meat. But now I work at a private club, so we do a lot of functions. And honestly, about 20% of everyone that comes to the function has a request now. It's an allergy, it's a preference. It's like, and so I'm so curious about the way people are relating to food now. I think part of it is just a lot more information. I think part of it is there's a big identity piece. I think people really identify. It's part of their sense of themselves now more than ever. And then who knows about what environmental stuff is going on that's kind of creating these allergies. But it's I think that we, and maybe part of it really is also luxury, you know, that we can relate to food in these all these different ways versus just being grateful to have food to eat. Like,
I don't know if this relates exactly, but your answers have me wondering, you know, a lot of these cultures come from having like predefined traditions, you know, like challah, or you know, you would know whose restaurant you were in based on how it smelled, or you know, and in America today, you know, if you walk down the street, you would pass 10 different, completely different, you know, aromas. How do you see that playing out in a culture where it's so, you know, somebody used the word fragmented, I think, I don't know if fragmented is the right word, but so much available and so much difference. Like, where do we go from here with all that?
You know, I think that, you know, I mean, I always like laugh when you walk into a restaurant and it's got the, you know, the spaghetti and the Greek salad and the, you know, like the whole
chicken soup,
like just the whole thing. But I do think though that there's really been sort of a resurgence of people digging into their roots. And you know, I mean, there's all these cookbooks that, I mean, I'm a little bit of a cookbook junkie. I shouldn't be considering how little I actually cook. I like to bake, but I don't cook a lot. But you know, there's really been a resurgence on so many different cultures. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Oda Lenghi's cookbooks. I don't know if anyone, Plenty and in Jerusalem. But you know, taking these traditional things and modernizing them a little bit, but really still maintaining the essence of it. But I think it's really cool that you can get anything now. And it makes fun, like the hunt for, you know, the best hummus. Like there's a new place in New York that opens the best hummus. Like,
a new restaurant that just opened in New York in Brooklyn, and it's called The Grandmothers. And every week they just take a normal grandmother off the street, you know, who applies, and she cooks for 40 people in the restaurant. restaurant, and they have different themes, whether it's Jewish night, Italian night, and something really, and people, it's getting the best reviews, because it's like, you don't have to be, you know, a top chef to cook a meal.
Yeah.
You know, some of the just old basic stuff, you know, anyone could put, you know, you cook a pot of soup. Yeah. And I think it is good that there is lots of stuff, but also a lot of times you're losing the integrity when there's so much, but it's kind of a melting pot, and it's good that there's something for everybody.
I come from no food tradition. Like like my family, just cooking wasn't a big part of my family. And something I think a lot about is like the resurgence of like pickling and the resurgence of like, you know, these really younger people
DIY.
Like getting into very traditional kind of farm oriented food. And I think it comes from a longing for that tradition, mm-hmm. like a longing of that mm-hmm. connection to food that maybe they didn't get from their families, especially if their parents grew up like I did. Mm-hmm. You know, so I know that's true for me. Like I'm very, like I said earlier, very interested in traditional baking. It's like I'm baking like, you know, the grandmother I didn't have, you know, or something. Yeah. Like, right. So.
It gives you a sense of history or connection to
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
That said, I think we should put Louise on the spot and make her read her food porn.
Oh, I don't know how much time we have.
I think we have a few minutes for that. No,
you mean the scene
with the chef?
Oh God. Okay. Does anyone want to hear?
That would be a nice way to end. Okay. Yes, this is a great scene.
Let me find the best place to start it. So this is. I'll read a shorter version of it. So my character, Olivia Rawlings, is a city baker, and she has fled to Vermont after a disaster and has gotten suckered into taking a job in a country inn. And so this is a couple chapters in. She's been working at the inn for like a month or so, and she works in the mornings, and the chef doesn't come in until later. And so she hasn't met the chef yet. This is their first meeting. And they're getting ready for a big dinner. Let's see. So I'll just read their conversation. So I have a couple of ideas. I dug my spiral ring notebook out of my canvas bag and flipped to the right page. Alfred and I got to work, heads down, leaning over our notes, his shiny with grease stains, mine streaked with chocolate. First course is a corn consommé, Alfred said. That's brilliant. Can you do that? Just the pure essence of corn. My mouth began to water. Then a salad? Baby red oat greens with toasted black walnuts and a maple vinaigrette. With goat cheese? I licked my lips. Alfred smiled and ran his fingers up and down his hairy arm. An excellent idea. I could make croutons out of dried apple spice bread. Alfred leaned in a little closer. Or maybe just a thin slice of apple bread with the goat cheese spread on it. Yum. We weren't even on the main course yet. What's next? Prime rib with a cipollini au jus. We get the beef from the Haskell farm. Not Snowball, I gasped. I had spent the better part of Tuesday afternoon letting the cow gum my coat sleeve. Alfred laughed. You'll get used to it. And no, not Snowball. She's a heifer, for one thing. She's used for milk and breeding. I let out a long breath. Only a couple weeks in the country, and I was getting dangerously close to being what all chefs loathed, a vegetarian. So what's the wraparound? Wild mushroom risotto with roasted Brussels sprouts. I can make popovers, I offered. Alfred closed his eyes. With chives? I smiled. Done. A cheese course would follow. Vermont cheddar with quince paste, fresh chèvre with homemade blackberry preserves, and a sheep's milk blue cheese with pears poached in port. And then dessert. Pumpkin creme brulees baked in a hollowed out miniature pumpkin. Apple galettes with frangipane and puff pastry. Pears soaked with cognac soaked figs and wrapped in phyllo, baked to a crispy golden brown, the fruit inside tender and succulent. And thin chocolate shelves filled with a thick amber caramel, studded with toasted pecans and a layer of dark chocolate ganache just barely sweetened. Alfred and I leaned back in our chairs and smiled at each other, our foreheads glistening with sweat. All we needed were a couple of cigarettes. It's going to be a meal to remember, Libby. That's it.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone. And your books are all outside, I believe. For